Good afternoon. I will call to order this meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorff to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watune.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson is present.
Representative Dabney. Representative Dabney.
Dabney present.
Dabney present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Representative Haley.
Haley present.
Representative Kegel.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegarde excused. Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson. Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
Tice present.
And Representative Richardson.
Quorum is present. Our first item on our agenda today is the approval of our minutes from February 2nd, 2022. Representative Cotiza Watune, do you have a motion on those minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move the minutes from February 2nd.
Representative Cotiza Watune moves approval of the minutes from February 2nd, 2022. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 2nd, 2022 are approved. The first bill on our agenda for today is House File 895 from Chair Joachim. Chair Joachim, the floor is, well, I will move, geez, skipping some steps here, sorry. Mm-hmm. I will move House File 895 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And I see that you also have an author's amendment, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. It's a quick technical correction just for the date on page, I think it's page 2, line 5, from 2021 to 2022.
Great. So I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it for the committee to consider. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Joachim, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing House File 895 today. I know you have a busy agenda, so I'll be brief. Thank you for adopting the amendments. This idea for this bill was brought to me by my neighbor, who's here today, Catherine Newcomb. Her husband, Charlie, was in a bad motorcycle accident in 2015. This bill has passed to the House floor in previous years, but has not gotten as far in the Senate. I also have Rich Runen from TSR Injury Law here, who will give brief testimony after Ms. Newcomb. But first, I want to give you a little bit of background. In current Minnesota law, motorcyclists are only required to carry or provide or maintain security for the payment of tort liabilities arising out of the maintenance or use of the motorcycles in the state. Security may be provided by a contract of liability insurance. You can see this language on lines 1.1 to 1.10 of the bill before you. Motorcyclists are not required to carry personal injury protection or underinsured motorist coverage. And your automobile insurance policy does not extend to you in the event of a motorcycle accident. This bill merely requires a motorcyclist to carry uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. This coverage is available and some folks do carry it. Those that do are protected when hit by another uninsured or underinsured motorist. Just a quick fact, nationwide, 14% of the folks on our road are not insured or are not insured. Why do I think it's important to carry this coverage? Number one, it's to protect the motorcyclist. Number two, it's to protect others. We require this insurance in our automobile policies. Why? Because we know the cost to the rest of us when motorists are injured and not fully covered. I do not frequently delve into insurance policy, and I know that there are those on this committee who have much more expertise. And I do understand the balancer system has tried to strike in requiring folks to purchase a variety of insurances. If it becomes too expensive, folks may go uninsured. I understand that. That's why I'm trying to strike that balance with this bill by only requiring uninsured, underinsured coverage and not personal injury protection as well. In 2019, I had consulted with folks in the insurance industry to find out what this would cost the average rider. So the following numbers that I'm going to give you may be a little dated, and is in all cases, it depends on the age of the rider and the type of that they are driving. This could increase a rider's insurance anywhere from 25 to 60%. For instance, a 45-year-old motorcycle owner at a lower liability limits would go from 100 to 160 if you add UM/UIM. A 50-year-old rider would go from 125 to 180. An 18 to 25-year-old rider with a racing bike would probably see a bigger increase, maybe upwards of $700 more, because they're a riskier bet. You should know that today many motorcycle owners already buy this valuable coverage. Agents surveyed have said they sell this coverage today to a majority of their customers around the 70 to 80% range. So is this a solution in search of a problem? I would say it's more about catching up our statutes to where the market is already going and nudging those along the way that haven't purchased this product. So I would like to turn it over to Ms. Newcomb for her personal story. And thank you for indulging me in a little bit of historical background.
Thank you, Chair Yuki. You have a couple testifiers, the first of which is, I believe, your neighbor, Kathy Newcomb. Ms. Newcomb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commerce Committee. My name is Kathy Newcomb. On June 5th, 2015, my husband, Charlie, was injured in a motorcycle accident. Charlie sustained multiple injuries, including fractures to his left wrist and both hands, as well as a dislocation to his left leg, which resulted in a total hip replacement. We were fortunate our health insurer paid Charlie's medical bills for the week in the hospital, 3 weeks in transitional care, and follow-up medical care. The driver of the other vehicle was uninjured and immediately admitted fault for the accident. After investigation, the insurance company for the other vehicle accepted 100% liability. However, the bodily injury limits under their policy were the minimum requirement under Minnesota No Fault of $30,000. Charlie had bodily injury limits of $100,000, $100,000, $300,000, property damage of $50,000, and comprehensive coverage on his bike. Unfortunately, he did not have the uninsured or underinsured protection on the bike. His medical expenses alone far exceeded the available liability coverage. Therefore, he was uncompensated for his pain, suffering, permanent injuries, and loss of income. In addition, I lost time from work and sustained out-of-pocket expenses traveling to attend to him during his stay in the hospital and transitional care, as well as follow-up doctor appointments. Prior to the accident, Charlie was always on the go. He enjoyed sports, having a good time. He was always up to a challenge. Charlie held a full-time job within a family business, demonstrating items, kitchen and yard tools, requiring travel 7 to 8 months out of the year. After the accident, Charlie's travel was limited due to the fact that he could not stand for 10 to 12 hours demonstrating and was no longer able to sit for long lengths of time driving to and from his work obligation. As a result, Charlie retired at an earlier age and much sooner than we had planned. Since the accident, it takes Charlie longer to get moving in the morning and sometimes throughout the day. Home projects that Charlie tackled in the past on his own now take 2 to 3 times longer for him to complete and often require the assistance of others. The additional metal in his wrists and hip as a result of the accident now make winters almost unbearable, as Charlie is constantly cold, even when he's wearing additional cold weather protective gear. Summers once included golfing and other summer sporting activities. Unfortunately, the surgeries to the wrists now make golfing and other activities difficult or impossible. Day-to-day tasks like buttoning a shirt or removing compression socks at the end of the day can be a frustrating burden and require assistance. Lists followed by gentle reminder calls and scavenger hunts for items misplaced are a common daily routine. As a result, my husband is not the carefree individual we knew prior to June 5th, 2015. He gets frustrated and angry with himself and is not as happy as he was before. I am here today to request, please, that motorcycles be required to carry uninsured and underinsured coverage, the same provision as other vehicles. And I would hope that in the future, this committee would also consider raising the minimum limits on the Minnesota no-fault provisions from $30,000 to $100,000. When the Minnesota no-fault law was originally enacted, the cost for medical care and living expenses were far less than they are today. Charlie will never be the same individual he was prior to the accident or able to accomplish some of the day-to-day items he could before. We realize this change in law will not help us, but it will protect others from being in our situation. By sharing Charlie's story, I hope to persuade a change in the Minnesota no-fault law by improving the minimum coverage provisions on motorcycles by requiring that they carry the uninsured and underinsured coverage, and in the future, increasing the minimum limits on all Minnesota no-fault policies. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb, for sharing your story with the committee, and I'm very sorry for the difficulties your family has experienced since that accident.
Thank you.
Sounds like it was a life-changing experience. The next testifier for the author is Rich Runin from TSR Injury Law. Mr. Runin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to speak in support of House File 895. I think it's pretty obvious that motorcycles should be treated like any other vehicle that's permitted on public roadways. Every truck, every car has to have UIM coverage, underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage, with just to be on the roadway. I did serve on the task force for uninsured motorist coverage and the no-fault task force as well for the state. And I agree with Representative Joachim's 14% number, but I think it's even higher when it comes to motorcycles. At least that's the evidence that I have seen. I should say I am an attorney with TSR Injury Law and a senior partner here, and I was former president of the Minnesota Association for Justice as well. So I've represented people who have been injured, like Ms. Newcomb's husband in this case, several over the years, probably hundreds of motorcycle crashes. These are often the most severe. People are hurt really bad. I've represented numerous people who had leg amputations as a result of motorcycle accidents. It's always severely broken bones, brain injuries, things like that. And these are the worst of the worst, unfortunately, because you don't have steel around you like you do in a car. And unfortunately, those people end up incurring hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills often. There are usually very few motorcycle accidents that don't at least have $50,000 to $100,000 in medical bills. And when that happens, somebody's got to pay for that as well. It ends up falling on the state coffers a lot of times with medical assistance. And even when people do have medical coverage, which a lot of people just have like the minimum, they end up having to file for medical assistance anyway because the bills are so great that their insurance doesn't cover it, cover all the bills. But even when there is adequate coverage, it falls on then the health insurers to pay the damages when the closest risk is really the insurance for the bike that should have been on there. The other thing that happens, and this has a huge effect on small businesses. Take my firm, for instance. We employ 35 employees plus our 10 lawyers, and we buy group coverage. And when you have, when you're a small and smaller business like that, and you have a huge amount, one employee, let's say, gets in a motorcycle accident, has $500,000 in bills, our group coverage goes up at sometimes 20 to 30% the following year because we've used so much in premiums. And so they base it on the people in your firm, in your business. So it has a huge effect on small businesses. Every year, the cost of health insurance goes up for small businesses, and it goes up even more drastically when you have a person who gets in an accident like this or gets really sick, you know, with other ailments. But, and this is something that if there is coverage that could pay for that, it would have, it would be helpful for small businesses. So that's what I think this is a great idea. I think we should treat automobile or motorcycles the same way we treat automobiles. I also agree with Ms. Newcomb's statement that we should increase the limits as well on all vehicles because 30,000 is just not enough and it hasn't been increased in a while. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. So I do believe this law is a great idea. I think it will help the motoring public and businesses, and it will help the state of Minnesota. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions if you have any, but that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Runin. That concludes the author's testimony. Testifiers will now move to public testimony. We have a few people signed up, the first of which is Frank Ernst. Mr. Ernst.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, or good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Frank Ernst. I'm a member of American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education in Minnesota. ABATE is the largest street motorcycle rights and advocacy group in the state of Minnesota. I'm reaching out today to ask you to oppose House File 895. That's a bill that would mandate motorcyclists to carry uninsured or underinsured coverage on each motorcycle we own. Forcing motorcyclists to carry an insurance product to protect us from damage that would be inflicted by others who may have inadequate insurance or no insurance at all is putting the responsibility on the wrong people. Responsibility should remain with the party causing the damage. If the liability insurance of the party causing the damage is inadequate and crashes, why are the victims forced to cover the loss they cause? While uninsured, underinsured insurance may provide a benefit to some, and while many riders do carry this insurance, it would be good to leave it as a personal choice. This bill that would mandate all motorcyclists require this insurance is opposed by a broad coalition of motorcyclists in Minnesota. Many feel it could lead to an increase in uninsured riders due to increased insurance premium costs. Some are concerned about the possibility that company that carries their insurance may not carry the mandated coverage that's required, therefore causing a need to change providers and again facing a probable rate increase. There are many insurance options that are available for motorcycles and may benefit, but these policies should remain options. Although many of us riders already have uninsured, underinsured, the concern remains that extra cost of this insurance could make motorcycle riding too expensive for some, especially for those young riders. The passage of this legislator may have unintended consequences. Some that face large increases in motorcycle insurance may choose to not ride or not purchase the insurance. ABATE of Minnesota and the people we represent ask that you oppose this bill. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Ernst. The next testifier is Aaron Cocking. Mr. Cocking.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Cocking, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just want to mention a few brief points this afternoon as this committee decides whether to advance this bill. The first and probably most important point is one that's already been touched on, and that the coverage is already available for motorcyclists to purchase on their current policies voluntarily. And the numbers I have seen suggest that the overwhelming majority of riders do already purchase it. And since this is a first-party policy, the mandate doesn't seem appropriate. Unlike an automobile liability policy or really any liability policy where you are buying a product to protect others or a third party from your conduct, this is a policy that protects you in the event that someone who harms you is uninsured or underinsured relative to the cost of your loss. Simply put, Mr. Chairman, first party policies are purchased to protect yourself. Third party policies are bought to protect someone else. Mandating third-party coverage makes public policy sense for the state. First-party coverage should be left to individuals to assess their own risk tolerance. Now, whether this bill advances or not, I think it's great that Representative Joachim has brought the issue to light. Hopefully, this will cause people to review their policies, contact their agents, and to buy this product voluntarily. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. Our last public testifier is Randy Swenson. Mr. Swenson.
There we go. Everybody hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Greetings, House Committee members, fellow bikers, and honored guests. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Randy Swenson. I am the Minnesota Legislative Director for the St. Croix Valley Riders Motorcycle Rights Organization, a group of approximately 650 Minnesota members. Our main purposes are to monitor motorcycle-related legislative action and to provide and finance motorcycle rider education for our members. I'm here today to address several concerns that we also have with Bill HF 595 regarding mandatory uninsured, underinsured coverage for motorcycle insurance. Let me preface my remarks by saying that I myself currently do carry both types of insurance on my motorcycle coverage. However, there is a very important distinction to be made, and that coverage was and is my choice. Our first concern is that we as motorcyclists value our independence very highly, and our organization is adamant that motorcycle choices should be left to motorcyclists, not to the politicians. Second concern we have is that a mandatory increase in insurance coverage will obviously result in mandatory increases in premiums. If customers cannot turn down coverage, insurance companies will be free to raise premiums as they wish. We fear that this will result in some riders choosing to forgo all motorcycle insurance due to pricing or being told what they have to carry. Beginner or low-income riders will be discriminated against by this action, while well-established riders with substantial collision insurance and excellent medical insurance will have no need for this extra coverage, but will have no way to exclude it. As the automotive insurance numbers have shown as well, there are drivers who will not tolerate another $100-plus expense that they have no voice to challenge and will instead forego insurance and not carry it at all. Please consider the impact your decision is going to have on the Minnesota motorcycle community, a group of approximately 200,000 registered voters. This is an election year, and our organization is very active in making certain that we inform our friends and colleagues which members of the legislature are biker-friendly. As for the Newcombs, I can sympathize with them, and I extend my sympathies and hope for that Mr. Newcomb feels better in the future. But the fact of the matter is, he made his choice. I also have made my choice. I do carry that insurance, and forcing that on people, on motorcyclists, without their consideration is not prudent. 14% or more of riders don't have insurance now, has been stated previously by a couple of the other participants. I fail to see how forcing riders to spend an additional $100-plus on insurance is going to improve that. All that's going to do is turn people away. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate your discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swenson. We now have gotten through everyone who signed up to testify, so we will move to member comments and questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that my questions today are necessary for the bill author, for others. I do have some comments. I first of all want to extend my sympathies to the Newcomb family. No one likes to be involved in a situation, particularly when it's not your fault in an accident and the repercussions that we have to live with every day on that. Secondly, I want to thank Representative Joachim, because I think this is the fourth biennium, or at least the fourth time that we're hearing this bill in the Commerce Committee or in the Commerce Arena, that she has introduced this bill. And my quick math and work on this tells me that about 70% of the people who own motorcycles in the state of Minnesota are voluntarily. Voluntary compliance of 70% of motorcyclists who are using this particular coverage. The other questions that I have would be, are agents talking to their insureds about this coverage? Thirdly, are people asking agents about this coverage? And I would submit to you with 70% voluntary compliance that we are absolutely seeing people raise this question and make a decision for themselves. In the state of Minnesota, we oftentimes see that we have concerns about people paying and buying insurance and keeping that insurance and the discussion of raising rates on automobile policies. What does that do to those who are insured? We have less insured people on the road or more insured people on the road when premiums go up. The comments that Representative Joaquin brought forward today, that an individual she quoted is $120 every 6 months, that would go to $180. That's about a 50% increase in the premiums from what that person's already paying. I submit to you that a 50% increase in premiums, members, is not going to entice people to want to buy coverage. It's going to have the exact opposite effect on here. Again, we've got voluntary compliance. Representative Joaquin, I think you've raised the issue. Sometimes you don't need legislation to do the right thing. And in this situation, 7 out of 10 motorcyclists, by information, are currently doing what Representative Joaquin wants to have happen. Folks, let's not put more uninsured folks out on the road with the potential by mandating coverage and raising rates. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Kazizowatun, you lowered your hand. Did you still want to speak, or are you all good?
I'm all good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm not sure I have a question, but I do have some comments as a motorcycle rider. I've been probably familiar with bikes since I was a kid. My dad rode, and I finally got rid of his bike a couple years ago. He's 85. So it's not something that has been new to me, I should qualify. My husband rides too. And last year, he was on a 26-day motorcycle ride. This year, he's going up to Alaska, probably for the same amount of time. And these guys understand what it means to ride because we've been riding for a long time and we appreciate the opportunity to have those choices. I will always have a helmet on because I don't need the wind stretching my skin out anymore and causing wrinkles. But my sons do ride and they ride. One of them rides basically for a living. He works in the motorcycle industry. And I will tell you, Representative Joaquin, his hair would have curled if he would have heard you call them racing bikes. They're sport bikes, commonly known as crotch rockets. But they are also a huge mode of transportation for a lot of our young folks. In fact, my CPA, when she was going to the technical college way back in the day, had a motorcycle because that's what she could afford to drive. And a lot of young folks feel that way. They want to watch what they're spending, and this is one way for them to do it. My sons, like I said, have chosen a path in which, yes, we make sure we have all our insurances because they drive interestingly. They have the clothing and the whole nine yards. So my point is, a lot of these motorcycle folks already know that they're up against folks who probably are not carrying as much insurance as they should, and those are the people that are hitting them. Our testifier, Mrs. Newcomb's husband, found that out too. But I would say the biggest problem is, why aren't we really checking to make sure that this is what our motorists are using? Because here we are. It seems like we're having to see an increase in our insurance rates because some people aren't doing it. And we've been talking about this for a long, long time. I'm not for this at all. I look at what we do with our motorcycles. They are recreation, but I might be riding my bike down to the Capitol too, if it's here and there. And the expenses that we pay, and we're seeing insurance expenses going up quite a bit. I just cannot say, let's do this at this time, because everybody's struggling with a lot of the costs. But not only that, what's the real problem here? Are we looking at our motorists with underinsured and uninsured? And to me, that's the bigger problem. we're already, I think, and maybe one of my insurance folks can say yes or no, but I think already if you're in an accident, you're already like 20% guilty because you're there. Just because you're there. And I'm not seeing anybody screaming, so I think I'm probably, that was the last accident I was in. I was 20% liable because I was there and I got hit by a garbage truck, but it was my fault because I was there. And I, those types of things just drive me nuts. They absolutely do. And so I just have a real problem with this. As a motorcycle rider, we spend a lot of time looking at how do we best stay safe. But I always know that I'm only as safe as the person, sounds weird to say, a person who may hit me, because it depends on what their insurance is. And if they're not carrying it, then I'm screwed. And I don't think that's right. There are a lot of things involved with motorcycle safety. And those of us that take it seriously know what they are. And we make our choices on what we want to do. And that's with anything we do in our lifetime. It's really hard to see another motorcyclist get hurt. And I can tell you a lot of stories. And I can also tell you some that I think are incredibly egregious, not because it was their fault, but because the person who hit them either just wasn't paying attention or didn't have the insurance or all these other things. And it really makes me sad to know that we come back to this all the time. I love bringing up, having an opportunity to talk about a lot of these things. But as a motorcyclist, I'm going to tell you I'm not in favor of this, because then what's next? And I kind of know. I kind of know what's next. But I will not be voting yes today, but I hope that we can continue discussions so that we bring up some of these issues, because I think they need to be brought up. But I think a bigger one is, let's really look at the motorists and what we can do on their part to make sure that everybody is safe on the road all the time, not just motorcyclists. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Katisa Mattoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question had been kind of answered earlier, but now I just wanted to share and to express my support for the bill. I'm not technically a motorcyclist. My husband is. I actually rode away from my wedding on the back of his crotch rocket in 2011. Bought a dress that would fit, hike up a little bit so I could climb on the back of that crotch rocket. And that's the only time I've not worn a helmet on a motorcycle. So I think that this is a great bill. Thank you, Representative Joaquin, for bringing it forward. I mean, I think, as Representative O'Driscoll said, if it's close to 30% of folks who just aren't carrying insurance, my concern is, are they even aware? Do people even know? And I think Mr. Cocking had mentioned, you know, hopefully this can get a little bit of news coverage, make people reconsider, have them have that conversation with their agent, because I actually had to text my husband during this hearing to say, hey, do you know if we have this? And so I'm going to reach out to our agent and make sure that we are carrying this, because I think just like some of the other testifiers, Mr. Swenson, Mr. Frank, who have already said that they carry it as responsible riders, I think that people just, they may not know. And what you don't know, you don't know. And I think that this could be a step in the right direction. So thank you, Representative Joaquin. My condolences to Mrs. Newcomb. And I appreciate this being a conversation. I'll be voting yes.
Thank you, Vice Chair Katisa Mattoon. Mr. Roonen, we're in member discussion now, so we won't have the opportunity to return to public testimony at this time. Representative Farr, I saw you raised your hand and put it down. Just want to make sure that you were you wanting to speak? I don't see you on my Zoom gallery right now. Well, before I turn it over, we have no other comments. Before I turn it over to Representative Joaquin for closing comments, I have a quick comment to make, which is that, you know, my dad, when he was in high school, skipped school one day and went out on his motorcycle. And he was driving actually in Representative Winkler's district, not far from where Representative Winkler lives now. And he hit a sandy patch and, slid. And his head slid right underneath a car going, in the opposite direction from him. And the car actually ran over his head. And he had a, as you might expect, he had a helmet on. He kept that helmet. It had a big crack right down the middle of it. And it was a powerful visual aid as he was telling my brother and I that we needed to wear our helmets when we were bicycling when we were young. And the reason why I mentioned that story was that, of course, back then and today, helmets are not required when you're riding a motorcycle in Minnesota. It was a voluntary choice that my dad made, even as he was skipping school. He was responsible enough to wear a helmet. And because of that decision, I'm here today. Without him making that decision, I wouldn't be here. And so when we talk about these as being a matter of personal freedom and individual choice, it's important to recognize that oftentimes the choices that people make have impact on other people down the road. And I think that Ms. Newcomb's testimony illustrated that very plainly, that her life is forever different because of the fact that there wasn't insurance on that motorcycle, just as much as her husband's life is forever different. And sometimes people who had no voice in the decision are impacted by the choices that other people are making. And I think that's why the legislature probably, or that's probably the reason why the legislature requires uninsured and underinsured coverage on automobile accidents, because we recognize that it isn't just a question of one individual's choice. There are cascading impacts on other people from the decisions that we make. And so I recognize some of the extra costs and that people will bear. Important to note that people who already have uninsured, underinsured motorcycle insurance won't pay more because other people have to buy it too. I think that, I'm not sure if that's what Representative Tice was trying to suggest, but I don't think that that's what would happen. But I think it's probably for the best, and that's the decision that the legislature made for cars, and I fail to see why it should be different for motorcycles than it is for cars. So there's the editorial comment of the chair. And with that, I will turn it over to Chair Youakim for her closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everyone, for the very thoughtful discussion. It's important to have all voices at the table when we consider policy changes, and I understand that. Just a note, my husband used to own a motorcycle that he commuted to college in and just sold it a few years ago, too. There were a lot of other issues brought up in this discussion that are beyond the scope of this bill. You have heard testimony from folks that have personal experience with horrible situations. I want to thank Catherine Newcomb for sharing her personal story and coming back with me time and time again to try to get this across the table. This bill doesn't go backwards to help the folks that have spoken today, but it can help people into the future. And I really am trying to strike that balance to make sure our roads are safe and people are protected. I believe adding a requirement for motorcyclists to carry uninsured and underinsured coverage strike that balance. That's why you don't see an added personal injury protection or even a helmet law in this bill. So I'd like to thank you for the conversation again, and I heartfully ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Youakim. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 895 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, no.
O'Driscoll, no. Representative Barr.
Barr, no.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, yes.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard excused. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Richardson, aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
Tice, no.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails and House File 895, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Chair Joaquin. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 2673, a bill by Representative Ryer. I will move House File 2673 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Representative Ryer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here to talk today to talk about House File 2673, a bill related to contracts between dental plans and dental providers. House File 2673 is a transparency bill. It makes basic information available to dentists and patients alike. It's also an empowerment bill that gives dentists decision-making authority over their business practices. This bill does three things. It requires that fee schedules be provided to dentists so that they can manage their business. It ensures that they have options for how they wish to receive claims payments from the plans. And it lets them know if the plan they signed a contract with is leasing out the network they're in and ensures they can opt out if they wish. These are reasonable common sense steps that support dentists in running their businesses and also help avoid confusion for their patients. I'd like to thank all of the interested parties who have contributed to this bill. I appreciate the engagement from the Minnesota Dental Association and the dental community, as well as the dental plans and insurers who provided their perspectives. While we're still talking through a few details, I'm confident that together we'll deliver legislation that helps Minnesota's dental system work even better for our dentists and their patients. Next, I'd like to invite Dr. Amber Chuck to testify. Dr. Chuck is the president of the Minnesota Dental Association and a practicing dentist in Litchfield. She'll explain this bill in more detail and talk about its benefits for the dental community. Thank you. I will look forward to your questions and ask for your support to pass this bill out of the Commerce Committee and on to its next stop at the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. As you mentioned, you have Dr. Amber Chuck here to testify. Dr. Chuck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Amber Chuck, and as Representative Ryer stated, I am the president of the Minnesota Dental Association and a general dentist in Litchfield. I've been practicing general dentistry and accepting multiple dental plans on behalf of my patients in rural Minnesota for 15 years since my graduation from the U of M School of Dentistry. On behalf of our organization, I thank you for providing me with the opportunity to testify on House File 2673. First and foremost, House File 2673 amends existing Minnesota statutes related to the disclosure of fees by a health plan to a provider. Currently, health plans must provide a full fee schedule in addition to other contract provisions before requiring a provider to sign a contract. However, it's important to note that currently dental plans are noticeably exempt from such disclosure. This presents an interesting dynamic in that dental providers today are asked to enter into contracts with little or no information on expected reimbursement for services to be rendered under such a contract. No other business transaction would be conceived of without the full disclosure of terms, conditions, and fees associated with such a transaction. House File 2673 eliminates this exemption and applies the current contract disclosure statute equally to health plans, inclusive of dental plans. A second important provision addresses reimbursement methods, such as virtual credit cards, that often impose fees to collect payments for the service that dentist has provided to the patient. Fees associated with these cards range from 2 to 5% and essentially require a provider to pay in order to get paid for the service. Several dentists have reported that some payers afford no other method of receiving reimbursement. And although this practice is not yet widespread in Minnesota, national colleagues are reporting an increase in this very practice. The provision does not prohibit the use of virtual credit cards or any specific means of reimbursement. It merely provides for full transparency in payment method, and more importantly, affords the provider an option of reimbursement, which does not incur fees. It ensures that at least one method be provided that doesn't require a fee for the dentist to access the reimbursement. The third important provision in House File 2673 addresses network leasing, a practice where a dental plan leases its provider network to another entity, which is often an unrelated dental plan. This frequently occurs without any notice to the contracted dentist. The practice results in confusion for both patients and providers. For the dentist, they may unknowingly be required to comply with contract terms and payments that may differ from the original contract. Patients may be confronted with a dental practice that has no knowledge of what may be covered by the patient's plan and leads to an unnecessary and potentially disruptive delivery of care. The bill's language simply ensures that the disclosure of a provider network lease arrangement to contracting dentists include any variations in the contract obligation and fees. It further and most importantly provides the dentist or dental practice an opportunity to opt out of such a leasing agreement without penalty. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill and help bring transparency and fairness to dental plan contracting. Thank you for hearing this important piece of legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Chuck. We will now move to public testimony. We have one testifier who signed up, Joe Lally from Delta Dental. Mr. Lally.
Mr. Chair, thanks very much. And thanks for the opportunity to testify briefly on this bill. I'm Joe Lally. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for Delta Dental of Minnesota. And I first want to commend the committee staff and the author for their availability and opportunity to have some preliminary discussions. This bill proposes some changes that we want really more clarification on. So I think what the theme of my testimony is that we want to continue to work and have discussions with the author and discussions with the Minnesota Dental Association so we can find common ground and make sure we have a clear understanding of what the goals are and how we can best accommodate those. I wanted to just touch briefly on the idea that the bill seems similar to some legislation that's passed in other states, including both Nebraska and North Dakota. And although we don't lease networks at Delta Dental, the bill's current language creates some questions with regard to what a third party is and that type of thing. These are details that are probably fascinating to only some dentists and Delta Dental, but they're important for that relationship, and it's important that we have a strong understanding so that we can work cooperatively. The language that's not in this bill but is in other bills clarifies that companies under the same brand, licensee, program, or affiliate are not considered network leasing. Like the Blue Cross companies, there are a bunch of Delta Dental plans. There are 39 plans. But in order to provide national service to large employer groups with employees in multiple states, each of those Delta Dental plans contributes their network to a national network. And as a result, dentists in Minnesota might get payment from Delta Dental of California or Delta Dental of Iowa, for instance. So we just want some more time to work with the author and with the Dental Association and identify some of the details. And I'm confident that we'll be able to do that. With regard to fee schedules, we just want to make sure that we have a clear understanding of the intent and purpose for the legislation, as well as how our current approach of providing fees to dentists comports with some of those same themes, and also what we could do differently to meet the goals of the proposed legislation. So appreciate the opportunity of the committee to listen to me today, and look forward to continuing to talk with the author and to visit with the Minnesota Dental Association to come to some common ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lally. There's no other public testifiers who signed up, so we will now move to member questions and discussion. Any members wishing to speak to this bill? Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Ryer?
No, thank you for hearing the bill. I look forward to talking with all parties to resolve these last issues.
Wonderful. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2673 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, aye.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Barr.
Barr, aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, yes.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard excused. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
No.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Richardson, aye.
Richardson, aye. And Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
Tice, no.
There being 12 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 2673 is recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The next bill on the agenda today is also from Representative Ryer. It's House File 2916. I will move House File 2916 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Ryer, to this bill. And you are muted.
Muted and can't even find Zoom. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here now to present House File 2916, which is a dental bill that addresses access to covered services. This bill acknowledges that there are limits on dental benefits that can affect the services patients receive, thereby limiting dentists' ability to provide the needed care. An example would be when a restoration of a tooth needs to be done. Frequency limits on x-rays may prevent coverage if an x-ray was already done on that tooth in the past year or 2 years. This bill will help us get coverage for the restoration and the necessary x-ray. I'm pleased to say that this bill also is the result of successful work with dental providers and dental plans. I thank all for your collaboration and look forward to addressing a few minor points as we finalize legislation that ensures that patients receive the care they need. Next, I'll turn it again over to Dr. Amber Chuff, who will explain this bill in more detail. Thank you. I look forward to your questions and ask for your support to pass this bill and move it on to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Dr. Chuck.
Thank you. Again, I'm Dr. Amber Chuck, President of the Minnesota Dental Association. This legislation is an attempt to allow dental clinics in instances when reimbursement is not available to deliver a service and subsequently collect.
Are you there?
Yeah. Okay.
Representative Driscoll, you may want to mute yourself. There we go. Dr. Chuck.
I apologize. This legislation is an attempt to allow dental clinics in instances when reimbursement is not available to deliver a service and subsequently collect a fee from the patient. There are instances where a plan will not reimburse a provider and simultaneously prohibit a provider from collecting any fee from the patient. The intent of this legislation is to remedy what we believe to be an unfair intrusion in the patient-provider relationship. However, in speaking further with several members, it has become clear that this is a much more complex matter, and the proposed language may require revisions to better address the issue at hand. We will continue to work with the author in hopes of refining the language prior to its passage. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill and help bring transparency and fairness to the dental plan contracting. Thank you again for hearing this important piece of legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions again.
We'll now move to public testimony and once again turn to Mr. Lally. Mr. Lally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Joe Lally. I'm Vice President of Government Relations at Delta Dental of Minnesota. Similar to the to Representative Ryer's other bill, thank you again for helping us understand the intent of the bill and helping us or giving us opportunity, I guess, to have further discussions. We want to join again with the Dental Association and the author to be able to identify ways to have language that is meaningful for all parties. The state passed non-covered, what we call, or I think what has been called non-covered services bill several years ago. That bill identified what a non-covered service is. And the analysis that we've been applying not only at Delta Dental, but at other plans, is that it's a two-part analysis. The first question is, does the coverage, does the state, or does the employee benefit set cover a procedure, say a cleaning, right? And then the second question is, who pays for it and how much? And so the first question is, if you have two cleanings a year under your benefit plan, your employer's benefit plan, if you want or need a third, that is a covered service, but it might not be a paid service. Similarly, if you're applying a deductible, that deductible, you pay the patient pays the deductible before the coverage kicks in. So those are examples of where it's a covered service, but not a paid service. So that two-part analysis is sometimes helpful. I think just similarly to say we stand ready to have additional conversations. I think the doctor mentioned that we have that opportunity and that the Dental Association agrees that we could continue to look at language and come up with something that works for all parties. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lally. There's no other members of the public who have signed up to testify, so we'll now move to member discussion and questions. Before we go into that, I will just comment that I did have a good discussion with Representative Ryer about this bill before the hearing today. And as I think you've heard from all three individuals who've spoken to it, there's still some work to be done on the bill. Because it has additional committee stops, we're going to move it. The plan is to move it along to the next committee stop today. With the understanding that that work will continue and that if need be, it may come back to Commerce, but I don't expect that will be the case. I expect that the work will continue and it will continue in the Health Committee. So any discussion or questions to this bill? Seeing none, Representative Ryer, I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd appreciate a yes vote.
Wonderful. I will renew my motion that House File 2916 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Aye.
Cotizza-Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, aye.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Barr.
Barr, no.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Kegel.
Aye.
Kegel, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard excused. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson. Was that an aye, Representative Richardson?
That is an aye.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
Tice, no.
There being 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 2916 is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for your two bills today. The last bill on our agenda today is House File 2806 from our own Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you remind me of the bill number again, please?
2806.
I move that House File 2806 be moved, considered for possible inclusion, laid over today and for possible inclusion in the Commerce Committee House Omnibus Liquor Bill.
Representative Driscoll moves that House File 2806 be laid over for possible inclusion in an Omnibus Liquor Bill. Representative Driscoll, to your bill.
Very quickly, this bill idea was brought to me by one of my constituents, happens to be the largest bowling proprietor in the central Minnesota area by far and away, and by a big swath, maybe from actually the Wisconsin border to the North and South Dakota border, probably from Brainerd down to the Maple Grove metropolitan area. They have quite an operation that's there, and they have been experiencing, like many have, some challenges with employment-related and hiring help and the like. And the idea was brought to me that maybe we could move the age from serving liquor, from taking a dinner order with a beverage order, bringing it to the bar, putting it on the tray, and bringing it back to the table from age 18 down to age 17. And Mr. Mathiason, Jason Mathiason, the proprietor of the Great River Bowl and Partners Pub, will be here today to testify as to how that would be beneficial to not only him, but to many in the industry. And Mr. Chair, I have heard to date no opposition. Just for in the way of full disclosure, it had been brought to my attention that this could be a question for the Minnesota State High School League, because you're working with those individuals who are still in high school potentially. And I have heard back in a conversation with folks in the league, and if we need to, we can get a written comment from them, I'm sure. But they do not have a concern with 17-year-olds being involved in this, because they have 18-year-old athletes who are currently covered by the law, and it is not the league's intention to stand in front of an employment opportunity for a youth individual, particularly in a situation like this, because they may come across alcohol in a professional environment. If they load trucks, if they are involved in a retail or convenience store or something along that line where they would come in contact with alcohol. But Mr. Chair, with that, I'm going to ask you to bring my testifier, Mr. Jason Mathiason, forward to hear his, and he is my only testifier today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And Mr. Mathiason, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to speak. My name is Jason Mathiason. I'm the owner of Great River Bowl and Partners Club in Starkville. This is a family business. It's been in our family since 1984. I've grown up in the industry. I've seen the ebbs and flows of the labor market, and nothing really compares with what we're dealing with currently here. This is a long-term problem. It's not a short-term problem. We've been hearing about the labor issues for a number of years now. We've been warned about it. The pandemic has just sped up that timeline and forced us all to react a lot quicker to it. We've been forced to change a lot about our operations in the last years. Labor is a tough one. It's tough to go without help, and it's tough to work around it. There's things we can do, but the bottom line is we're looking for help. In discussing this idea with Representative O'Driscoll over Thanksgiving, the concept seemed to be a simple and common sense approach. As a license holder, I am the one who's bearing responsibility for all my employees. They represent me, whether they're 18 years old or 75 years old. They're representing what we do in all areas of our business. We're constantly training and evaluating staff in all of these different areas. I make choices every day about which staff can and will best represent me, our policies, and our procedures. I have several employees on staff right now who are 17-year-old seniors in high school. They've been with us for a long time now. They understand our values, our procedures. They understand what we do and why we do it. Two of them will be 18 in a few weeks. They get it. I trust them right now. I would trust them to do most of what we require of a lot of our staff. Others I would not put in the position to serve alcohol right now. Simply put, I don't think that they're ready to handle it yet. I also have several employees in their 20s and 30s who I wouldn't put in that position right now because I don't think that they can handle it appropriately. All my colleagues in Central Minnesota are struggling with applicants not showing up for interviews or not replying to requests to set up interviews. The high school labor pool in our area is seemingly one of the only healthy pools with applicants who are wanting to come out and work. These are good, hardworking kids. Many of them are kids that some of us have coached and gotten to know in our community over the years. They're a good source, but unfortunately, our industry has age requirements on it, and lowering the age requirement to serve alcohol to 17 helps us to fill a huge void in our industry. It gives us almost a full extra year with them during their senior year of meaningful and helpful employment and filling that void. I just end with reiterating what I've already told you. We're constantly training our staff. We do it on a regular basis in all areas, cleanliness, procedurally, talking about the importance. Being an owner and a liquor license holder in our industry, we take it very seriously. It's a great responsibility. when I put that employee on the floor, I remind them, you're representing me, you're speaking for me, you're acting for me. I don't take that task lightly. Only those who can handle that responsibility get the privilege of serving food and beverage for us in our industry, in my building anyway. I make these choices weekly when I put the schedule out and I publish it. These standards would remain in place whether the employee is 17, 27, 67, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is I have to make those responsible choices. I have to decide who I'm going to put out there and represent me in the best light and keep our operations going the right way. And I think I know my staff well enough, and I know that these 17-year-old kids can do it. They've already proven that they can. And so I'd ask for you to consider this bill fully over and appreciate the time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody might have.
Thank you, sir. We have no members of the public who signed up to testify, so we will now turn to any member questions or discussions on the bill. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak in support of this bill. I know so many restaurant owners that have really struggled, you know, during this pandemic. One in particular in my district in Lake City, a very, very popular place to eat and very well run. And most of their staff over the summer months are college students. And what happens then when college students go back to college, you lose that staff. And as the previous testifier just said, then they rely heavily on high school students. But when you don't have the ability to have that staff serving beverages along with a meal, the restaurants, it just makes it very tough for them to make it. And this particular restaurant ended up closing because he couldn't find the staff that could also, you know, work the bar or serve a meal with a beer. So it's a real workforce issue and an economic issue for small restaurant owners. And therefore, I just wanted to voice my support for this today. And I think it also helps high school kids get needed work experience. So thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a clarifying question because I think the top line brief in the memo and then actually the full text of the bill might be differing. I was reading that it was folks under the age of 17, but then when I read it further, that it was 17 and up. So I just wanted to clarify that it's 17 and up and not under the age of 17, because there's two different pieces of information that I was seeing that have different information.
That is my understanding, that it's 17 and up, but Representative O'Driscoll?
That is the intention, Mr. Chair. As you and I have talked, we don't think that 10 and 9-year-olds should be serving alcohol. We thought 17 is a pretty responsible group of people. So if there is something, since it is being laid over, and if there is an area, as Vice Chair Keyes Watun points out, we certainly can get a language correction if necessary. But the full intention is 17 and up, and you'll also notice in the bill that is a 2-year window that we were looking at. We're not planning on making a permanent change. We figured this will be a way to get through some of the labor issues as well as see if this is a something that warrants a longer-term solution or if it's covering us for the interim.
Well, I don't know, Representative O'Driscoll. My 9-year-old has gotten me a beer from the fridge during the Vikings game from time to time, so I'm not sure that I'm totally on board with your...
Well, I will notify the league immediately.
Representative Katiza Watun, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I appreciate the confirmation, and I think this is a good plan to look at over the next 2 years and help out some of our hospitality businesses. Thanks.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Jason, for your comments and for bringing this forward, because I am reminded of a dinner date that my husband and I had in the local establishment, and our server was phenomenal. And just we chatted with him, and he had been working extreme hours. In fact, he was going to higher ed classes and for the very fact of being a business owner and being in hospitality. And he decided he was going to get a better education for right now, doing what he did. And he was 19. So I think a lot of folks are already looking at what they want to do further down the road, and this is just another benefit of let's get kids more interested earlier about what's available to them and what it means. So thanks for doing this, Representative O'Driscoll, and Mr. Mathiasen, we had a great time at the bowling alley on Saturday. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Representative Tice. I see no further members seeking recognition, so I'll give the last word to Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, like Representative Tice, who traveled to my district to partake in a fine establishment, I would certainly invite all of you on your next trip around central Minnesota to stop in and see our great friends at Great River Bowl and Partners Club. And I think that this is a very interesting approach. We've got some pretty good guardrails on this. It helps businesses because, as Mr. Mathiasen said, we can get a couple years of service out of folks. They build a good skill set. And the service and hospitality industry can make good tips, which can help those individuals with their college endeavors or other post-secondary endeavors. So I think it's an interesting way for us to approach it. And I thank you for the time today, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Mathiasen, for your testimony and members for the discussion.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, and for bringing this issue forward and for the work that we've been able to do together on it leading up to session. I think it's a strong candidate for inclusion in our liquor omnibus that will be forthcoming. And with that, I will lay over House File 2806. And that being the last item on our agenda for today, our meeting is adjourned.